Well, good evening and blessings to all of you. It's a joy to be back with you again. And well, I think it's, what, 3-4 years ago that I was here, something like that, three. I should have checked, I guess, but didn't do so. But in any case, I am here by invitation of your leadership team. And I want you to know right up front that BMA, Biblical Mennonite Alliance, is aware that we're a very young organization. We're new on the Mennonite scene in America. And we know we're learning as we go, and we've kind of grown faster than we had really quite anticipated, and that always brings a lot of extra challenges with it. And we also know that no organization of churches, no fellowship of churches can be all things to all people. And I personally, as well as most, I can't speak for all, but most of the ministers within the Alliance, we are not a parochial people, and we try hard not to be critical of others. I personally made the decision, it was a 3-month process for me, to leave CMC, Conservative Mennonite Conference. It was a very difficult decision because I had invested about 30 years of adult and ministry life in Conservative Conference and had a lot of very positive experiences there. And the decision to leave does not reflect in my heart any kind of condemnation of CMC. I do differ in a number of areas with them. And initially, those of us who were from CMC, which was most of those who initiated the movement that became the Biblical Mennonite Alliance, we felt like CMC had made some steps theologically, or at least hermeneutically, that opened the door for a much more liberal future theologically. And I said numbers of times earlier when I was president at Rosedale and had a good bit of contact with the broader Mennonite church through the Mennonite Board of Education, where I would meet those people and meet Mennonite educators practically on an annual basis and sometimes in between. I said to them sometimes when we discovered how far we were apart theologically, I said, I really have more in common with evangelicals who are theologically conservative than I do with you guys. You have a very different view of the Bible from what I have. And basic doctrines had been eroded by that time. Questions about the virgin birth and the deity of Jesus and bodily resurrection and just a lot of things like that. Where evangelicals with whom we differ on other issues, maybe the really big one we would differ with them is on non-resistance, but some other issues as well, and yet they have the same Bible as we do. They have come to different conclusions. And I have personally seen the Lord work in congregations and in people who have very different backgrounds than what I have, and even very different worldview right now. Though predominantly Christian, but quite different from my own. I know a number of Catholics whom I'm convinced are born again. If you think that isn't possible, Menno Simons was born again for at least 6 months before he left the Catholic Church. He didn't just get saved when he left the Catholic Church and became a Mennonite, right? And I've met a few Mennonites about whom I wasn't at all convinced they were Christian. Have you met anyone like that? I'm saying that to say I'm just not parochial. I have preached in non-Mennonite churches, and I've been in first-generation Christian settings in other countries, both Mennonite and non-Mennonite, where I've seen the hand of God. And I know that the world is bigger than Mennonites, and it's a lot bigger than BMA. And not any, like I said, no group like us can be all things to all people. And if you don't get anything else tonight, I want you to get this. I wasn't invited to court you as a congregation. I was invited to introduce BMA. You must decide whether or not you feel led of the Lord and think it would be an advantage or helpful to you to be a part of BMA. And should you decide not to do so, then I am not going to say, what's wrong with those people in life? They don't have much life, or something like that. Just thought of that one. But anyway, the point is that you need to make the decision, and I'm not here to try to woo you. It's not like a courtship. But I do want to answer any questions you have, and I want to make just a basic introduction about who we are and how or why we came to be. And I think that we can have fellowships of churches like this, and even within a given congregation, accountability with those who have common understanding and conviction. And we can be stronger groups that way if we don't build our walls so high that we can't fellowship outside of that small circle. There is a thing called organizational unity, and much of Christendom had that until the Reformation and had become very corrupt. But there is the bigger issue of spiritual unity, and I have spiritual unity with every other born-again Christian that I meet. And I've often sensed that. And I am able to reach beyond my denominational roots and my present fellowship and commitment for accountability and responsibility. I can reach beyond that and accept brothers and so on. For instance, like at Rosedale. Yeah, I chose to retire from there. And I think the last year I taught was 2000. I chose to retire from there and exert more of the remaining energies I have, and they are draining. I mean, my energies are draining because of my age. But I chose to do that because of the opportunities and the needs within BMA. We have our own school, and I do some teaching there. This was planned to be my last year in teaching at Elnora Bible Institute in southern Indiana. But I believe a lot of good things are still happening at Rosedale. In fact, I know they are. And I have a very high regard for the present president there, Dan Ziegler. Do some of you know him? He's a Pennsylvania guy. He's not from Anabaptist Mennonite heritage, but married a Mennonite girl, became a committed Anabaptist himself. But just the other night, a couple weeks ago, Dan and his family were in our church, and they've been there numbers of times and have ministered there. He has ministered there. So we don't have big walls around us. I go back to Rosedale occasionally, but have chosen to be a part of BMA rather than a part of CMC. That's a personal choice, and like I said, a difficult one. I want simply to let you know who we are, and have you then as a congregation working with your leadership team make whatever decision you decide as a fellowship to make in the coming weeks and months as you make a decision regarding that. Let me just use an overhead to kind of make it a little easier for you to follow me possibly. The first two lines there have to do basically with our beginnings historically, just to give you the time reference there. The first exploratory meeting was in October of 97. I was not at that meeting. Now, I did have another appointment, but I probably would not have gone had I been free to go, because when this came about, because Conservative Conference had voted in July August, I think it was August of 1997, on the issue of whether or not a person, a minister, could retain ministerial credentials within the conference if they had no convictions for the veiling, and if the wife, and there were a few such cases where the wife had rather short cut hair and would not wear a veil even for worship. And the question was basically finally focused this way, that anyone who would want to retain ministerial credentials within CMC would need to embrace, not necessarily have the personal conviction maybe, but would need to embrace and respect the position that a woman should have long hair, it did not say uncut, but long hair, and be veiled for public worship. And then the ministry was to vote, yes, that should be required, or no, it should be left to the individual conscience. And at that time, there were quite a few. I had just been the conference moderator, in fact, helped lead it up to some kind of a decision regarding that, and was now part of the ministerial committee, and two of the brothers in a five-member ministerial committee that was actually responsible for putting all of that together. Two of those five brothers said, if that is required, then their church and they personally would probably leave conference because it would be too confining and too legalistic. And there were others who said the same thing. But then when the vote was counted, and it happened, ironically, at United Bethel, we had the ministers, the conference session was at Rosedale at the Bible Institute, and the ministers' meetings were at our church at United Bethel. And when the votes were counted, 45% voted to retain the veiling as a requirement, and 55% voted to leave it to the individual conscience. That was a dark day for me personally. I don't know how you personally feel I should have felt, but I just felt like, you know, my zeal for conference just kind of died with that vote. And I know a lot of women who do not understand the teaching about the veiling that I'm sure are Christian. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying the question is, should we hold each other accountable for truth we know? And I know that some of the ministers then already believed that the teaching in 1 Corinthians 11, the first half of that chapter, was simply a local tradition and had no bearings even in the early centuries beyond Corinth. I heard them say that. And I knew that the church from Pentecost to 1962, the Catholic Church and many Protestant churches, for 19 centuries plus, understood that that was not a cultural issue. The Catholic Church gave liberty to worship in public in 1962 without a veil. And Protestant churches, some of them did that after World War I. But prior to that, and even up to, in our area, the Lutheran churches, women did not worship with unveiled heads until after World War II, the 1940s. And then Mennonites began to do it in the 1960s. And now, within like the MCUSA churches, and in most of the CMC churches, coverings or veiled heads are very rare. And I'm not the judge of that kind of person's salvation or standing with God, but neither can I ignore both the scripture or the history and feel at peace with that practice. That was really the watershed that right after that conference session, one of the men, having met with like 12 or 15 others, I was busy and had not been in on that meeting, came and asked if I would be willing to come to a meeting and maybe even head up a meeting to discuss the possibility of forming another organization. I said, it's too early, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm not going to get involved at this point. It was not until the spring of 1998 that I got involved. There were 16 ministers at this meeting, all but one from CMC, and 15 of them did vote that there should be a committee formed to look at how to organize and then have a beginning process for organizing another group. And then it was in the summer of 1998 that I was then involved, and the name was chosen. And that name was chosen, that second statement, the rationale being that pastors who could no longer support the basis or the direction of CMC were led to establish the Biblical Mennonite Alliance, and we also observed interest among some unaffiliated congregations. They had asked about it and so on. And when they heard that there was some discussion of this happening, we had a number of pastors ask if anything's going to come of that. And we really didn't know quite. When we actually organized, it was somewhat tentative, like in my case and the by that time it would have been four other ministers, because we had ordained two to replace myself, and then a year and a half later, Brother Alan Yitzi, as we retired. So they would have been ordained already, but those were also a part of the initial organization, but it was subject to how our church would vote. And if the church would have voted not to join BMA, and that was done in August of 98, then we as ministers would have withdrawn, because we said, membership was subject to that, because we were not going to be divisive between us ministers and the congregation. The congregational vote was then 82%, and so United Bethel did go with BMA. Then I want to just give you kind of quick-like and explain things we talked about, prayed about, agonized over, for the simple reason that we knew that you have a problem, a tendency toward a problem within conservative Mennonite churches to kind of want to freeze the culture and lifestyle and hold on to things. And then you develop in one or two generations a Mennonite culture. And it may or may not be biblical, it may not be unbiblical, but people from different backgrounds from us would not understand why. It's like that story, or I don't know if any of you have ever watched the film, were about the Jewish community tradition. Oh, Fiddler on the Roof. Have any of you seen Fiddler on the Roof? Shame on you. You watch movies? Well, anyway, I've seen it twice, so I'm probably worse than you are. But it has a tremendous message. But I like this other story, too, about the woman who said they always cut their ham in two when they bake their ham for Christmas. And they couldn't figure out why that tradition was now three generations old, and they finally asked one of the older grandmas why that is. She smiled and said the only reason she knows is they didn't have a big enough roaster to start with, so they had to cut it in two. That can happen in a church, not with the ham, but with other things. And we didn't want to go there, although we didn't want to say that if a person or a church wants to maintain and promote for themselves a, quotes, Mennonite culture, conservative Mennonite culture, that's okay. They can do that. But we're not going to expend energy trying to promote a conservative Mennonite culture. And that is still our commitment. Now, there are in BMA ministers and churches who want to do that to a point and do it. But they don't do it with our encouragement, if you know what I'm saying. And it's their privilege to do that. But we decided to try as hard as we can to be biblical so that we could explain to people of non-Mennonite and even non-American Western cultures why we don't do certain things and why we do other things. Because it's in the Bible, as best we can understand the Bible. And we're humble enough, I think, to admit that we don't have it all figured out perfectly. And over the coming years, there can be even some changes in how the same biblical principles are applied and practiced. But we're just not interested in requiring things like plain coats and cape dresses and particular styles of veilings. See, if you stop and think about it, the veiling is taught in Scripture, but the type of veiling is a cultural question. And if you're too adamant about a type of veil, then you're making a cultural issue out of the veil, and it's basically a scriptural issue. You follow where we're coming from there? That's the kind of thing we talked about a lot in those early months of organization. And we wanted to adhere to an Anabaptist biblical doctrine and practice and have accountability for pastors and churches, a commitment to servant pastoral leadership. We do not require or even deny the privilege of ordaining bishops. But did you know that bishop, pastor, shepherd, minister, elder, five terms were interchangeable in the New Testament and in the first 150 years of Christian history? Then, after about 120 years, they began to have second ordinations, and they were ordained then as bishops, and they had authority over ministers. And then you had monarchical bishops over bishops. And then you had archbishops over monarchical bishops, over ministers, over deacons. And then finally you had cardinals. And in the 5th century they had 7 tiers, from the local priest to the Pope. Pope Leo I in 440 saw himself in the church, saw himself as the papa of the church, the Pope. And they went on to develop the doctrine that he has the same authority as Jesus. Jesus is now in heaven, so he becomes the vicar or the vicar of Jesus, the pinch hitter. He's there in his place. We decided, even in CMC already, that there is no real biblical basis for ordaining bishops. Why not designate senior pastors? And then if the church or the pastor decides to make a change, you don't have that awkwardness, well, he was ordained a bishop. And what often happened in American Mennonite experience was that bishops became very authoritarian, and they even, very sincere ones, thought that was their responsibility. They had to keep the preachers in line, and the preachers, and especially the deacons, had to keep all the people in line. And the deacons became the errand boys of the bishop. When I grew up in the Amish church, when we saw Dan Garber's buggy, heard it first, coming down the street, down the road, we knew his horse's gait, and we knew the buggy had always leaned. He had very poor springs in it. And he'd sit on one side, and the buggy would lean like that, and the horse looked like it was half asleep coming down the road. He was coming either to collect monies, because they never took offerings in church. But if someone had a big bill or if there had been a fire, then he was coming to collect the monies, the offering. Or he was coming to admonish someone. How would you like to be a deacon like that? Do you have deacons here? You don't. You really need a deacon so he could do all your dirty work. But anyway, no, don't do that. That's not the biblical basis for deacon ministry. It's to minister to practical needs. But I emphasize that we want and believe strongly in servant pastoral leadership. We also wanted then to have collectively what we can't do very well, just one congregation, to have missions and evangelism and have that consistent with our BMA positions, and then have spiritual formation opportunities for our youth, the Bible Institute being a primary one, but not a singular one, and then pastoral and congregational fellowship. The organizational structure is that you have your local congregations under a plural leadership team. Often there is actually a lay element of elders and ministers. And then you have regional groups of churches with an overseer. And then you have a board of executors and a council of overseers, a mission board, and a Bible Institute, and your publication persons involved, and so on. And that would then give us the organizational setup that would help us be organized enough to be accountable and practical and be able to accomplish the things that we felt the Lord would want us to do as a group of churches without having a heavy-handed kind of leadership. The biblical safeguards against apostasy, I've been asked a number of times when I've made presentations, so I'll ask the question and answer it for you before you do. What is the guarantee that BMA won't go the same route as other groups within the Mennonite family have gone? There are no guarantees. Any generation is multi-generational, just like you are here tonight. I think I'm probably just about the oldest person here. Not quite. Sister Byler is just a little older. But I said a whole lot older. I think it's 3 months. But in any case, the local church is multi-generational, but even all of you who are involved at Life Ministries now will not really have control of what happens at Life Ministries 30 years from now, 35 years, that's about a generation. Because a whole new generation will have come up. There are no guarantees. I think there are some safeguards. But spiritual life is just that, spiritual life. And you can't guarantee it for successive generations. But we have tried, we think that if we are accountable, and the ministry gives leadership in that, but the congregations to whom ministers are accountable are finally the source of authority. We really do believe that the locus of the authority of Jesus is in the local assembly of believers. But that local assembly, scripturally and logically, is led by men called by the congregation, given authority by the congregation to give leadership. Not that the authority shifts from the Lord, that's where it all is, but it's delegated to the local fellowship, but it's not delegated to the minister, and he is the authority over all the church. He represents the authority of the Lord in the church. And often it feels the same way, basically. But a minister dare never forget that he does not have intrinsic authority. And if he begins to throw his weight around, the church does have the power, the authority, to ask him to step aside. A minister can be silenced by a congregation, and it's done a lot. It's done in churches that have very different organizations where you might have a council of laymen who hire and fire their pastors. And that happens within some of the Mennonite churches I'm aware of, where they fire pastors. Well, I'm not suggesting it should be done that way, but if we get out of hand and out of place, then we are not above and have no authority outside of what the congregation has authenticated us for, authorized us to have. Representing the authority of the Lord and the church in the brotherhood, in the gathered assembly. We believe also that with having teaching, reproof, correction, and discipline, you might recognize those four terms coming from 2 Timothy. All scripture is given by inspiration is profitable for these four things. Happen in local congregations, in regions, regionals, that could be a cap, should be a capital, in the larger alliance, and then the propagation of faith in nurture, evangelism, and missions. But that doesn't guarantee it. Let me remind you that the book of Jude was written at the end of one generation of primarily Jewish Christianity. And what does he write about? Apostasy. One generation. And the sad thing, I've preached a number of messages from that short book, but the sad thing is that apostasy doesn't happen in a group unless it happens first in too many of the individuals in the group. But it does happen. And in some cases, churches go for numbers of generations and do wonderfully. It seems almost inevitable, given the human condition, that churches and church movements tend toward apostasy. So we're not making claims. We're saying in this generation, we want to be faithful. It's best we know what that means. And we want to pass that on. But there are no guarantees that it'll always, will always succeed. We're going to try hard. We are trying hard. This organizational flow chart, it's sometimes called, gives you some idea of our intentional servant leadership thing. Most flow charts would have the CEOs at the top, right? And in our flow chart, that would be this body right here, the board of executors. And oh, it feels so good. I'm a member of that board. You didn't catch that, I don't think. You know what? If we understand authority, the authority of the Lord correctly, the more authority roles we have, the more aware we are of the authority we are under, not the authority we have. You understand what I'm saying? If, and I'm being facetious now, but it makes the point, when I was a little Amish boy and really did have a sense of call to the ministry, I really thought I'd be an Amish preacher. I said that to a couple rather spiritual Amish brothers who were preaching at a funeral, and I commended them. And I said, you know, I grew up Amish and I always thought I'd be an Amish preacher, and I was going to go on and say a few more things. And just as soon as I said that, one of them said, well, it's not too late. I could still be an Amish preacher. I was tempted to ask if I could keep the airplane if I put it on steel wheels and painted it black. And I think they would have enjoyed that, but I didn't do it. But here's the point. I've said already, I would have had no idea when I was a little Amish boy that I would grow up to be a Mennonite preacher. And yeah, I was ordained a bishop. That's quite a star. And wound up on the faculty at Rosedale, scared witless that first year, and didn't think I'd make it, but I did. 4 years later, the board came and asked me if I would accept the role of president. So I became a bishop, pastor, president at Rosedale, on the faculty, belonged to several larger church boards and things like that. Oh, and I was a husband. Boy, I like that one. And a father of 5. Look at all the authority roles I had. But guess what? I was under a much tighter level of authority over me than I ever thought I would be when I was a little boy and didn't dream of those things. And I'll tell you, if you aspire to an authoritative role, you'll be disappointed if you ever get there, because it's not from the inside what it looks like from the outside. And I would say furthermore, I really think if authority is a main aspiration, then we probably are not qualified for the role, starting with husband and father. But anyway, congregations are at our top. Regional overseers and the regional councils, meaning the ministers of all the churches of a region, and then all the ministerial members, are that second level of authority and responsibility. And then there is that board of executors and that council of overseers, which is comprised of all of the overseers of the different councils or regionals, and a chairman of that board. And then we have, serving on the board of executors, we have the chairman of the council of overseers is here, the editor of our publications, the principal and chairman of the school board, principal and or chairman of the school board, and the president of our mission board, plus a moderator, assistant moderator, and a secretary treasurer. So you wind up with the kind of oversight that the board of executors have, that see that the others are doing what needs to be done. The council of overseers is primarily a strong attempt to keep a good bit of unity in the context of allowing for diversity, as long as it is not biblically unsound, and so on. That's basically how we're organized and who we are. And of course, we have our mission board called Destinations International, and we have our Bible Institute that is of interest in many cases. And whether you would join BMA or not in the future, involvement with our mission board or with attending our Bible Institute, you're most welcome to do so. That's clearly an open invitation. And you're actually encouraged to attend any of our meetings just to find out a little better who we are. And when you do that, don't expect that everyone you see there is a part of BMA. That's not the case. We have a lot of people in every one of our meetings that are also checking us out, as it were. And we have people whose churches, we have ministers and laymen, whose churches are not apart, but they feel a kinship with us, and they come rather regularly, but they're not a member. And some of those have practices that are somewhat different from our own. And we try to accept and love people where they are, even if they are quite different from what we are. So, and this winter, next Thursday night through Sunday noon, Cornerstone will be hosting the the midwinter ministers enrichment week. And the meetings will not be at the church. Oh, I don't have it right in front of me now, but it's at the Effeter Business Center. Yeah, it'll be at that location. You're certainly welcome to be there. Now, another question that usually comes up, so I will go ahead and answer it, but you feel free to raise questions then, and I'll try to answer any questions you have. The question comes up, what is the process by which a church would become a part of BMA? And what would be, quotes, required? That's usually what people are interested in. What would it take for any given congregation to become a part of BMA? Well, the simple answer to that would be that, of course, the leadership team would need to become acquainted enough with who we are and what we believe and practice, what our minimums are, as it were, what we would expect. They need to be familiar enough with that and in agreement with that to the point where they, as a leadership, would embrace our positions. And then we have what we call our statement of position, our policy and position statement. But what we're doing presently, we're revamping that one a bit and trying to clarify it from what it initially was. And it has not been approved yet. We hope to do that this next week. But we're not using that necessarily at this point. But back in 2005, this summer it'll be 4 years ago, the ministers did agree to a series of questions that whole paper is called, and your ministry has copies of these, and I'll leave some more for you. But it's front and back. It's basically 12 statements, six on the front, six on the back, where you have three options in answering your unity with that statement. The first one, number one, is you just disagree. And if you disagree, we would ask that you tell us particularly what or why you disagree, what you disagree with or why you would disagree, so that we would know, or your ministers would know. And the second option is, I mostly agree. That would be circling number two. I mostly agree. And there again, we'd say if there's a part of it that you don't agree with, it would be nice if you just told us what it was for our learning and probably for your thinking it through more. The third option is just simply to say, I agree with this statement. I embrace this. That's the way we determine where a congregation is. Is a congregation really substantially unified with us in doctrine and practice? And it's not a judgmental thing if you're not. Now, we would expect that the leadership would be ready to embrace these, even if not everything is a personal conviction. But they're ready to embrace these. See, in most relationships, there has to be a little give and take, right? Anybody here who's been married a long time and never had to do any of that? Give or take? Sometimes men do all the taking, but that's not good either. Sometimes they do too much giving, maybe also. But in any case, marriage is a matter of some compromising, right? And I doubt if too many of you here at Faith agree with absolutely everything that your leadership would like to see, or even the majority of the congregation. Is that too pessimistic? But we learn to give a bit. And we're saying that in this case, if you would want to pursue membership, there would have to be a vote of the congregation. Because we do not want to be the basis of divisiveness within any church. So if you vote on this issue down the road, we would need a letter from your pastor saying when that meeting was held and what the percentage was. We don't set a percentage. You have to decide as a church. I personally think it's bad news to set a percentage ahead of time in most cases, not every case. But if you set a percentage ahead of time, you set it up for the minority to rule. If you take the council of a church by vote and feed that back to the church and say, look, we've got 70% on an issue, would the 30% have it in their hearts to support the 70%? And in the years we've done that at United Bethel, almost always the number goes way up, usually into the 90s. Then you don't have a minority rule like you would have if the number's two-thirds, and if that's the way you want to do it, it's okay. You don't have to do it the way we would recommend. But we would need to know that a substantial number of you want to become a part of BMA, your leadership wants to become a part of BMA, and that a substantial number of you would either circle two, mostly agree, or three, agree on most of these issues. We do not expect 100%. We've had about two churches, they were much smaller than yours, that had 100% votes to join and had 100% on the assessment paper. But that is unusual. And we do not turn churches back that have a goodly number of persons not fully agreeing or even in some cases disagreeing with our minimal requirements. What we say we think is biblical, what we believe to be biblical. If you don't believe that with us in too many of these issues or too many of you, then fine. You lead your life the way you feel you ought to, and we'll continue doing ours. You don't need to be a part of BMA to be Christian and to have a good church. That's not where we're coming from. But if there is a disagreement, then we would expect that the teaching and preaching and example of the majority in the church and of the leadership would win over a substantial number of those who would disagree. And if that doesn't succeed, then in some cases, persons will decide not to retain membership in a church where they don't agree. And when I was pastoring, I would often, over the years, it often happened that I would talk to people who obviously weren't in agreement, and their practice was a cause of concern for many of us. And you'd find out that it just was not a conviction with them, and it just wasn't working. And I would say after a while, you know, I don't really want, as a pastor, in any kind of public way, discipline you for something you have no convictions for. But if you really can't support what we believe to be biblical, I would like to urge you to find a church that is more in favor with you, or practice what we do, even if it's not a personal conviction, out of respect for the conscience of the majority. And some chose that route, and some chose to leave. And in most cases, persons who left, I retained a good open relationship with them. I didn't write them off, and they didn't write me off. We agreed agreeably, you know what I mean? To disagree and yet not be judgmental of each other. And that's what we would do in BMA as well. Churches that don't have, quotes, written or understood disciplines, and understand you have some understood ones and you have the 1963 Confession of Faith, that is the Confession of Faith that BMA has embraced. So you'd be on target there. And we think that these statements basically explain and apply, in some cases broaden a bit, the 1963 Confession of Faith, but we don't believe any of it is inconsistent with the 63 Confession. And so that's where we're coming from. And I have recommended to churches that if you don't have a written standard, if you want to look this over, and you'll need to do it if you want to even look at membership within BMA, look this over. I'll just read over it real fast in a moment here. But read this over, look it over, talk about it. This could become something of a covenant of membership that you are expected to respect, if not even embrace as personal conviction and practice, of course, but to respect these and practice them within the congregation as long as you are a member at Life, if Life would decide to become a part of BMA. And that, of course, would have to be a church decision. Any questions in regard to that before I just read these off? Yes?
If you have a question, get your hand up. It's being recorded, so we want the mics. So
okay, yeah, you've got a mic handy there. If you have a question, just raise your hand at any point, just so I can see you, and we'll get a mic to you, and we'll go with it from there. Any question at this point before I just read over these? This may spark a few questions. And as I do them one at a time, feel free to raise questions. Then we'll be focused on that particular point. Anyone with a question now? Okay, let me just quickly read over these. We'll not take time to discuss them. That'd be 12 things that could take 5 minutes each, and there you got an hour. Won't do that to you. But let me just quickly explain. These are basically statements that you would say, I agree with it, I disagree with it, or I mostly agree with it, you know, one of those three. Well, first, number one would be disagree, two, mostly agree, three, I would agree. The first statement is that my belief is in harmony with the articles of faith described in the 1963 Mennonite Confession of Faith. That's simply a yes or a no, you know. Number two, through the guidance of its leaders, the church has authority for direction and discipline. Notice, however, what we're saying here. We're not saying through the guidance of its leaders, the leaders have authority for discipline. The church has authority for discipline. One of the hardest things I ever did as a pastor, and I did it more often than I wished, was to lead the congregation in excommunicating someone who persisted in sin. And we made sure every time that we had gone way beyond Matthew 18 in trying to win them. But it wasn't always possible. And in one case, no, two cases, persons within the church, because it was a family member or a friend, in one case family, one case friend, said, do you like to kick people out of church? Well, one asked it. The other one said it. You just like to kick people out of church. I'm not ashamed to tell you, I just broke down and bawled. I hated it. But I felt scripturally responsible to lead the congregation, and I didn't do it. I led the church, but the church did the disciplining. We didn't do it without a vote of the congregation. The third statement, God's gift of sex is to be reserved only for marriage, and all forms of homosexuality, lesbianism, bisexuality, bestiality, incest, fornication, adultery, and pornography are sinful perversions. I don't think we've ever gotten anything but threes on that. I would hope we would never. Number four, the Bible is clear on the permanence of marriage between one man and one woman. Therefore, initiating divorce or remarrying after divorce while a former spouse is living is considered to be outside of the will of God and thus unacceptable. That is our position. Not everyone who has joined, either by way of ministers, I think I would know of at least two cases where they think we're a little too narrow there. And I don't know about within the church, probably a number of people. Again, we're not saying it has to be your personal conviction, but we would ask that you not teach contrary to it, even if you have a different opinion on that particular subject. We personally believe that even if we should be a little narrower than God might be, that we're being as honest as we know how to be with Scripture, but also we believe, in fact, it can hardly be argued, that the evangelical church, and now even the liberal Mennonite church, is not much of salt or light to our culture, because evangelicals have a higher divorce rate than the whole population together. You know why that is? Because practicing Jews, devout Catholics, and devout Orthodox, whether they're Episcopal, Anglican, or Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, those groups divorce substantially less than evangelicals and pagans. And someone did a study on this, I forget who it was, and said that clearly evangelical Christians divorce and remarry a bit more frequently than pagans, non-churched people. Some think it's because of the rank Calvinism that is taught in a lot of circles, where if you get tired of your wife and you get rid of her and get another young chick, sorry for that, girls, but ladies, but you know what I'm saying there. Often happens in the late 40s, early 50s for men. You're going to lose some of your rewards, but you can't lose your salvation according to rank Calvinism. You can see how that could factor, right? It does. The largest percentage of a state's population that is evangelical is in the state of Oklahoma, and the largest evangelical denomination there is Baptist, and they have substantially higher rate of divorce and remarriage of any state in the Union. So we make no apologies for this particular position. Number five, human life is a special gift of God and is not to be premeditatively extinguished under any circumstances, whether by abortion, assisted suicide, murder, infanticide, or euthanasia. Number six, personal appearance. And here in 6, 7, and 8 is where we start meddling. You know what I mean by that? We get practical on some things that are not always popular. That's called meddling. The personal appearance of the true Christian believer must present a clear witness to biblical teachings of separation from the world's influence in such matters as modest apparel, gender distinction, and simplicity. Shorts, tight-fitting clothing, or any apparel that draws sensual attention to the body has a tendency to cause impure thoughts and therefore must be avoided. It doesn't spell out a lot of detail, but it gives basic guidelines about the undress of our time and so on. And again, we're not interested in promoting a, quotes, Mennonite culture, but the more pagan our culture becomes, the less able we are going to be to just buy their clothes and dress like they do. And it will mean that we won't appear like they do. And yet there are many, Christian and even non-Christians, who dress rather modestly. And we're not suggesting that we have to dress differently than they. Menno Simons ministered in Holland and over in the lowlands of Friesland for about 26 years, 25 and three quarter years, something like that, with most of that time a 500 guilder reward on his head. He did not appear different than the people around him. And here is a quick little history lesson. Do you know where most of the distinct attire, dress, among American Mennonites and Amish, do you know when that started? How recent is it? After the Civil War. And most of it after the turn of the 20th century. My father, who grew up Amish, sometimes wore a tie before he joined church. No big deal. In fact, my oldest brother did it. He's 17 years older than I. He sometimes wore a tie before he was baptized. And Mary Jane's grandpa was the bishop I grew up under. And there was a spell there where the Amish boys, the young boys, had suspenders and belts. And one day in church, when he was preaching with a little smile on his face, he said, "It seems like some of our young men have extremely heavy pants because they have to have a belt and suspenders to keep them up." You know, kind of a sense of humor. But my father said that when he was a young man and a young married man, and mom and dad married in 1914, he said, "We Amish in Plain City were not as different from our culture as what you are at United Bethel today." And he said that in 1969, 2 years before he died. And then with a little smile, he said, "You are more Amish than we were." You know what he meant by that? More separate. It's really quite recent. The plain coat, you know where it comes from? From the officers' uniforms under the French general. Just lost his name. Napoleon. And they had that fancy mutza cut in the back. And when in the 1870s and 80s, neckwear for men became, quotes, ostentatious, you know what that means? Highfalutin and show-offy. Amish and Mennonites began to ask the question, should we go there? But so did the Salvation Army. And the Salvation Army went with the plain suit and no neckwear. And some Mennonites thought, now that's a good answer. And then we got mixed up with his whole thing. He also, Napoleon also had his officers wear mustaches. And so they decided that's military. They adopted the military coat, but said the mustaches are military. Knowing the history, I just smile. And I'm sure the Lord kind of shakes his head and says, boy, we really are able to strain at gnats and swallow camels, you know. Or to make gnats out of camels and camels out of gnats. All right, let me finish real quick. Like all distinctive, all decorative jewelry, the wedding band, and any makeup that alters the natural appearance should not be a part of our practice. The only thing we admit is that the wedding band, you can't strictly say that a plain wedding band would directly violate Scripture. Decorative jewelry, we believe, does. But when we were hammering this out, even in the starting of BMA, we saw both in history and in Mennonite experience, we did not know of one denomination or one congregation that could embrace the wedding band and keep from embracing decorative jewelry within a generation. So we decided not to go there. Plus, it is not a biblical symbol. Now, the veiling is a symbol, right? And it's biblical. But the very people, Protestant and Mennonite, who lose the veil invariably embrace the ring. And that's so meaningful. But it's cultural and it's extra biblical. It may not even be unbiblical. But we decided not to go there for those two reasons, because we don't know of any church who... Did you know that for a while under King, under Henry VIII, when he led the English church away from Catholicism so he could marry the young girl he wanted, he just told the Archbishop of Canterbury that you're going to be the new head of the church and you're going to absolve me of my marriage, or else, and or else meant your head comes off. And so he absolved his marriage and married him to the younger woman. What was her name? I keep forgetting names. But anyway, for a while there, they threw out the wedding band because it was popish. Do you know where it originated? In Catholic monasticism. Monks first began to put a ring on, and it was a plain ring, on the ring finger of the left hand when they took their final vows of celibacy, poverty, and submission. Then the nuns began to do it. And the nuns, I think, first in the convents began to say, we are now married to the Lord. And from that connection with the wedding, with the band of monasticism, they connected marriage, and then they started doing it in the church during the latter part of the Middle Ages. And it was widespread at the time of the Reformation. And a goodly number, if not most, of our first generation Anabaptists wore wedding bands. Ta-da! If I'd had a good time machine, I'd have gone back and told them to take them off, but I didn't have, so... That wasn't the big issue then. It is a bigger issue now. And you may disagree with it, but that's where we are. That's what we really believe is best. Then on the veiling and long hair, these are the two statements. The Bible teaches man's unveiled head. That doesn't mean you can't wear a hat for weather and warmth and so on. That's different, and it's in the Greek, a different word than veil. But we believe the man should be unveiled in prayer and so on, and short hair. He should have short hair. And a woman should be veiled and have natural length hair. The best application of the headship ordinance for the sisters is to wear their veiling as a part of their regular attire. And while a uniform style is not required across the alliance, a veiling of substantial size is required. Both men and women are expected to take seriously their commitments to the application of these biblical teachings. And then right in connection with that, the next statement says that the proper application of the leadership order is for the Christian man to take seriously the biblical command to be a Christ-like leader in the home and church, and for the woman to complement him as his helper. That very statement is what the Baptists got in trouble with the public media about 5-6 years ago for saying that very same thing. But it's right out of the Bible. Really is. Now, here's one, the media issue, that is often an issue. So let me just read it and explain it. Television and the internet have a potential to influence us and our children in a negative way, emotionally and spiritually. Each member shall exercise spirit-directed caution in the use of all media. And whenever the use of media promotes an ungodly worldview or a desensitization to sin, such use must be avoided. Emphasis, use. We're not saying such media. Although, if a congregation does have a position and is agreed on a position not to have television in their homes or not to have the internet access without the safeguards, we have no problem with that. In fact, it's probably the preferable position. But we do not say a congregation has to have a position against television or the internet. But there are other means. Radio is corrupt too, a lot of it, and a lot of magazines are corrupt. And it's even true that if you walk the mall in the summertime, it's corrupt. And, you know, close to pornographic sometimes. Yeah, the point is that we are living in a very technological world. And today you can actually get these little, what do you call them, iPods or even complex phones that you can watch TV on them. And you can get all kinds of trash in all kinds of ways. And it's a little hard to say and impractical to say, stop the world and let me get off. But the outback sometimes, the Australian outback, sometimes looks attractive, although they're having quite a bit of fire, not in the outback, but elsewhere now. But the point is, we're not saying hard and fast, no TV, but we are saying that if you do allow TV, then as a congregation, you ought to be accountable and responsible enough to have some means by which on something of a regular basis, no less than once a year, that the heads of the homes look a pastor or elder or a brother in the church in the eye and give some account for how media is used in their home. Because we can't just turn these things on and let them run without destroying ourselves spiritually. Well, that's about it. We have two other statements I don't think you'd have a problem with. Fathers are responsible for media use and what they allow in their homes and the influence it brings, and congregations should hold fathers accountable, or family homes, heads of homes, for media in their homes. Jesus teaches that in Matthew 18 that we are accountable to each other and offers instructions for approaching one another, and members are expected to participate in these steps when offenses occur. It's not just a minister's job. That's what we're saying. Any questions? Anything at all? I'll be glad to answer anything if I can. If I can't, I'll just admit I don't know. But if you have any questions, feel free to raise them. Anyone? Yes?
Why did BMA begin a separate Bible school when we already have Faith Builders, SMBI, Heritage, and others? And if it gets, too many small places can't have a large enough library that they ought to have, etc.
No. It's a good question, and we actually raised that first with SMBI. We knew that there would be some difficulty with a few of the other small schools that are quite a bit more conservative, where plain coats, cape dresses, that kind of thing. And, you know, I didn't know till fairly recently. I guess I'm not very observant. But here in the East, most of your coverings, let me just see yours, Starlight. Yeah. Starla has a covering that has, what do you call them in English? This, a what?
Band.
A band, yeah?
It's a
two-piece covering. Well, Mary Jane is terribly worldly, and she doesn't have a two-piece covering. In the Midwest and West, they just weren't there. And it's within the time since I retired from pastoring that I noticed there was a difference. And some people think if you don't have a two-piece covering, you don't have a covering, you know? Well, some of that is what we knew there would be some problems with some of the schools. SMBI, we felt relatively good about, although they have moved a little more in that direction, I'm told, in the last number of years. But in any case, we ask SMBI if they are at all thinking in terms of enlarging, and they said no. And they are already having a list of waiting, a waiting list, and they encouraged us to go ahead and have our own. Plus, we felt like in some ways we are approaching this a bit uniquely in that we do want to hold each other accountable to be biblical on issues that are there in the Bible, but we don't want to just necessarily promote a Mennonite culture. And so we went ahead and started our own school. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes, another one. Sure. Several. Okay, let's get them all. And others of you, be ready.
I don't want to monopolize. Why does BMA have a deacon for an overseer?
Jay Lockman. Yeah. We consider deacon ordination as an ordination to ministry. And in his case, the church has recognized his gifts, and he is actually a church administrator at Cornerstone. Was before they came into BMA. And the leadership team there said that he is gifted in that kind of thing, the very things that overseers would need to do. Very frankly, I pushed for, and others of the overseers, in the process of calling him to be an overseer, we pressed for having him recommissioned as a minister. And the church and Jay didn't want to go there. And so he's still a deacon, but we made him an overseer too, and he's doing a bang-up job. And would very likely, if life came into BMA, he would very likely, I can't tell that for sure, but very likely be your overseer. And if you had a preference for that, you could have a say in that as well. You had another question yet? Sure, go ahead and raise it. Does that answer your yeah, okay. Mm-hmm.
How can we lovingly and appropriately relate to our nearest BMA congregation when some of us have had some very unfortunate experiences with the overseer of that congregation?
Mm-hmm. Okay, I would answer that this way. It takes a lot of grace sometimes. You know, occasionally I've had to have a lot of grace to live with Mary Jane. Just short little periods. In this case, it might be longer, you know. But it is an exercise in our Christian graces to be gracious with those with whom we differ and have even been disappointed with. And we recognize the differences within BMA. And I'm quite sure I know who you refer to. He recognizes those differences. And even though it's not his personal preference, in fact, in his case, earlier on, before they became a part of BMA, he said to me one day, he said, you know, if you guys just took a position against facial hair and musical instruments, we would join in a moment. And I said, and if you could explain to us from the Bible that we should, we would do it. And he never did it. And he decided, okay, they can go that route, they can be a part of BMA, and he has sat in ministers' meetings or in convention meetings where musical instruments were used, and he had to exercise grace. So we also have to exercise grace going the other way. And he and I are good friends, but on some issues, we're on opposite sides. You know, okay? Yeah, he understands as an overseer that he cannot impose his wishes. And it's an interesting thing that for what, about 2 years, he was overseer at Cornerstone and they loved him. It worked. Because, and I did a little preaching, you know, that he had to be overseer to the congregation there, even if it's not like he would have it if he were the bishop there, the pastor. Yeah. Okay, were there others? I think there was someone back here. Was it? Someone back here that, yeah, over here. Yeah, okay.
Talk about the difference between a bishop and an overseer.
The bishop and an overseer, the overseer is primarily the overseer for the local leadership. Now, it is true that anyone in the congregation can have access to him. And so that is a good bit like the bishop, except that in the old standards practice of bishop, they would do the marrying, the baptizing, the serving communion, that sort of thing. That is not the case. Overseers do not do that for the local ministry, that kind of thing. I personally take care of some of the young churches that are scattered and are not a part of a regional. And if they don't have ordained ministers and they want me to, I will go in and do communion or baptism for them. But we also authorize anyone who is chosen as a lay elder to give leadership, they can baptize and they can serve communion in that role, you know, without ordination. So there is a good bit of difference in that regard. Plus, an overseer is appointed and his time is termed, where a bishop, ordained bishop, that's for life.
And yeah. Secondly, talk about how you said that they don't impose their ideas on a congregation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that would be like this. As long as the congregation is not openly violating the things they agreed upon when they became a part of BMA, then there is no imposition on the part of the overseer. He will work with the local leadership if they see a problem within the congregation. Which reminds me, I think I heard that some have said in the area here that when Cornerstone came into BMA, then they clamped down on some of the things that people were practicing that they didn't like. That whole process, and I can see how that happened, because that whole process went like this, that their covenant was one of the better covenants we have run into in across the BMA. And they were committed to it as a leadership team, lay and ordained, and said that's what they want. And they said, we have been negligent. And so we took them in. We recommended them for membership, and they came into membership with the knowledge on their part and ours that they had an element that was not at all practicing their covenant. And they had a policy earlier and had neglected it somewhat, took it up again, that every year they have to re-sign that covenant. And they would sit down with all their people, and those who were not practicing it, they would say, look, are you with us or aren't you? And so there was a certain clamping down, but it didn't come from us. They said they wanted to do that to start with, you know. So we simply bless them in doing it. And that's what overseers do, is help congregation leadership to find ways to teach, to exemplify, to persuade, and even to help in some cases where persons just don't want to be a part, to graciously find fellowship elsewhere. That's basically the way we have our overseers trying to function. Yeah. Does that answer the question pretty well? Any other questions? Anyone? Yes, one back here. Mm-hmm.
What's the relationship between BMA and FMC?
FMC would be
FCM. Sorry.
Fellowship of Concerned Mennonites. Yes.
Sorry, I said
okay.
That wrong.
No direct relationship. Fellowship of Concerned Mennonites. Actually, I was involved in its inception in 1984, and was actually chairman of that for a while. And we saw as our ministry an attempt to speak prophetically into the larger Mennonite church. And in the process of their reorganization and such, and when we became aware in several, we had two what we called conversations on faith put on by the larger Mennonite, the General Conference of Mennonites, before they had MCUSA. They put those on. And in those two meetings, we discovered that we have different Bibles, meaning The simplest way for me to say that is most MCUSA pastors and educators will tell you the Bible contains the Word of God. What's wrong with that statement? The Bible is the Word of God. And they will even say that you need a graduate study. They're requiring seminary training for ordination now. You need graduate study to be able to discern the Word of God in the Bible. When that happened, I said, we have no message to the larger church. We don't have a common basis for discussion. They have one Bible, we have another. We can discuss that issue, but they weren't interested. And so, you know, it's like on the creation issue. When I was president at Rosedale in 1984, in that Conversations on Faith, a prof from Goshen made his case for the book of Genesis, what he thought the first 11 chapters are. And it's some kind of a written form of literature that is not intended to be taken literally as history. Willard Mayer presented the other side, being on the faculty at Rosedale, and the president of EMC came to me after that, those two presentations. In the supper hour, he came to me and said, does Willard's position of creationism and the historicity of the first 11 chapters reflect the official position of Rosedale? I said, yes. Oh, he said, that presents a problem because we grant credit for your hours you grant at Rosedale. And if we're going to do that, we're going to have more of a unified position. He said, why don't we have a group of men from our faculty who are into the earth sciences, and your faculty sit down and see if we can't come to common ground. And you know where they were? Theistic evolution. I said, I understand what you're saying. You are into theistic evolution, and you're wanting to find common ground. Or you might not grant credits for our studies. I said, if that's what you want to do, you can do it, but there's no point in a meeting, because we're not changing. And he said, well, I'm very sorry to hear about that, but they never did withdraw giving the credits. They still do, as far as I know. Yeah, that just represents a very different world. And FCM, Fellowship of Concerned Mennonites, has changed its ministry. I have gotten so busy. I'm still on the board. I'll go to meetings when it fits my calendar, but my schedule, but I'm not actively involved because the mission has changed, and I have other responsibilities, so I'm only a peripheral member. There is no organizational connection. See, there again, Paul Emerson is involved there, and he's also moderator until 2010, and then he will be stepping aside as moderator. Okay? Does that answer the question, I guess? Yeah, well, I'm finished if you are, but I don't want to shut anyone off. You have another?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just noticed the different names, you know, that were on the committee there and the board members that were associated with BMA. And I know
Todd Neuschwander
articles that come through there that I had a question sometimes. So I was just wondering what the relationship is.
I've heard numbers of those things that I have nothing to do with that personally. And I've heard questions about those and gone back and read them and had some of the same problems and realized the same thing. Yeah. In defense of Paul Emerson, he comes from a Baptist background. He pastored as a Baptist. He was educated as a Baptist for the ministry and made the decision from his study of Scripture and history to become an Anabaptist. And I respect him very highly for that. But he does not have our background and sometimes comes out at different places than we do quite on some issues. Sometimes surprisingly conservative, other times surprisingly not so, you know. But he's probably just as surprised with what he runs into with us too, you know. Which means, again, we have to have some grace, you know, with each other. All right, any others? I don't want to prolong it, but I don't want to squelch discussion either. And if you have questions beyond this, you can get them to me through Mark or however you want to, even directly, if you'd like to do that by email. Email preferably, but even phone as well, if you would like. Any questions? Anyone? If you're finished, I'm finished. Okay, well, thank you very much. You've looked interested. Didn't see anybody sleeping. So you're either good actors or you were interested. God bless you. Good.